Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery on Round Rock, where we talk about games, comics, and other stuff on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And let's go to the show for this week.
You're listening to Roguecast number 163, and it is Free Comic Book Day week.
Yes.
We record this in an office packed to the gills with free comics.
Yes. Painfully, claustrophobically, sweatily packed. Yeah, that's right.
We suffer for your art.
It's sweat-packed.
So Free Comic Book Day is on Saturday. Starts at 10. People will probably start lining up about 9 o'clock.
Yep.
And we will have cosplayers in during the day.
Yep.
We will have tons of free comics to give away.
Yep.
Dave is going to perform an a cappella rendition of Ave Maria.
Yes.
I believe, as always.
It's possible.
Yeah.
It's that, or Beastie Boys Sabotage.
Right, yeah. Or Boyz II Men's Hard to Say Goodbye.
Yeah.
Really, it's hard to tell. But Dave will definitely sing if you bring him enough drinks.
They'll be able to vote poison?
Yes. That might not be true, but what is true is that we will have lots of free comics, and there will be cosplayers.
Yes.
And so we were going to run down some of the free comics that are available this year. There are 50 different free comics this year.
Right. Nice round number.
Yep.
We'll actually have more, though, because we'll have a few odds and ends left over from previous years.
Yep. Yep. We always put out some of the other... So if you missed some of last year's offerings,
yep,
we have some of those, too. And if you are a member, if you're a Rogue Gallery member, you have a Rogue card, you can email us at a time and hold up to 5 books for yourself.
That's right. You get that stuff in the queue.
So
then you can leisurely stroll in at like 4 in the afternoon.
And pick over whatever's left.
Yep.
All right. So we're going to run down the books. We didn't get a chance to read everything because A, there's 50 books.
Yep.
And B, it's been busy.
Super busy.
Yeah. So, but we did all get a chance to read. I know this is my top pick for this year's offerings. That is Star Trek Next Generation Mirror Broken.
And of the ones I've read so far, which I still need to read some more... easily my pick as well.
This is Star Trek Next Generation, the Mirror Universe.
Something that never showed on the TV show.
No, although there was something in Deep Space Nine, I guess.
Yeah, no, Deep Space Nine did it, and Voyager... Voyager did not, but Enterprise did. But for whatever reason, Picard's era never got around to it.
So I have a silly question, to start out with.
Yep.
Why are they sleeveless? All of them.
Everybody's a bro.
That's because it's piratical.
Okay, yeah. So that is their
It's theme. Purely an aesthetic. It's like everybody is kind of... It's not even just that they're evil, but there's like this like sinister guile that kind of informs almost everything in the Mirror Universe.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Picard looks very sexy with his goatee.
He is.
There's actually a cool backup feature where they talk about the costume design in it, and they have some of the alternate designs
for both Data and...
They're like, one of them was like, oh, we were going to use this Data one, but they said that jacket looked too 90s Guy Gardner or 80s Guy Gardner.
It looks a little 80s Guy Gardner meets the Terminator.
And then somebody was like, he's like, it did look like 80s Guy Gardner, but I wanted it still.
Data's also very borged up. This is also leading into a miniseries, by the way. The Mirror Broken is going to lead into a Mirror Universe. Yes. And the way they get into this, there's a character, I don't reveal who it is, but the character they use was a pretty clever point of view character.
Right. Not somebody you would necessarily expect, not even quite part of the main crew, but you'll get eyes on what's going on in the Federation or, you know, I guess they were like the Terran Empire or something like that way back in the 60s Star Trek, and you kind of see how that progressed through to Picard's time.
Who's doing the art on this? I think it's really nice.
J.K. Woodward.
Yeah.
Okay. Who also did the Doctor Who Star Trek.
That's right.
So, he's good. He's really good at like capturing likenesses, but also big action scenes. Yep. There's true to Mirror Universe form. There are assassinations, cruelties inflicted.
Yep.
A dark sense of humor. I'm going to say too, and everybody looks sexy.
So that is almost certainly going to run out before the end of the day. But
yeah, we'll be pitching it.
It's a good one to get. Then there is the I Hate Image special.
That is my pick.
Yeah, which is really good. I Hate Image is. Image last couple of years has offered up sort of reprints.
Or Savage Dragon books.
Which was a reprint.
Yeah, it was a reprint.
So it's kind of nice to see them going on. Not only do they have this, they have a book called Kid Savage. It's a new all-ages book. But I Hate Image is...
What is it?
This is I Hate Fairyland.
Yes.
Cutting her way through the Image... She's trying to find her way to Fairyland.
Who's the character?
Gertrude.
She finds that there might be a way if she goes through like the Image universe. So she goes through Saga... Walking Dead,
Bitch Planet,
a few
basically
other...
this little homicidal escapee from like a fairy world is tearing it up through all the Image books.
There's also like a 90s dance club where all the there's lots of little visual references too. This is like kind of like, you know, a top 10 Alan Moore's book had all those visual references. There's a couple big splash pages where you see a character from this or that. It's really fun. I know Dave's concern was that if you didn't know I Hate Fairyland or you didn't know Image, you might not get much out of this. There's so many references in this, you will get it. And even if you don't, it's super fun.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
That's the thing. There's just... people love Scotty Young's artwork. You know, there's going to be kids wanting to pick this one up because the artwork is so cool. Yeah.
It's a little dark. Well, yeah. I mean, it's a little mature.
Yeah. We'll just warn their parents a little bit that they will be forever destroying their child's mind.
Sure.
Then there is Catalyst Prime, The Event, which is a launch for Lionforge's new superhero universe. This is basically, there's some kind of meteor headed to Earth, and these scientists, or these astronauts, have to go up to prevent it from hitting. Something happens, and it's going to wind up leaving them with superpowers. So it is the beginning of their shared superhero universe. It's an interesting first issue, and the first issue of that, that's going to spin out of that, called Noble, is also out this week.
I forget, Randy, I'm mixing up a few different sort of comic projects, but is this the one where they had some pretty notable creators in their stable? Or am I thinking of somebody else?
You're thinking of somebody else.
Okay. It's nice looking, though. Like, that's some cool looking art. I need to read it.
Secret Empire number, I guess, number Free Comic Book Day, because there was a number zero.
Yeah.
Yes.
That is basically a lead into Secret Empire.
Like 0.5.
It's got Andrew Sorrentino artwork. It's, and then the flip side of that has a teaser for the Peter Parker Spider-Man book that... Chip Zdarsky is going to write, which I thought was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's good.
It's, what is it, like 6 to 8 pages or something from it?
Yeah, just a little Spidey versus the Vulture with a little bit of Mary Jane. Not marijuana.
If you think that Zdarsky was good at writing Star-Lord, he's even better at writing Peter.
It's really good, and I think it's what a lot of people are going to want out of Spider-Man.
Speaking of Star-Lord, Marvel did do another one, and it was the All-New Guardians.
Guardians of the Galaxy with the creative team that did All-New Guardians of the Galaxy this week.
Yep.
Jerry Duggan and Aaron Cooter. And then the backup of that is a Defenders teaser with Brian Michael Bendis, David Marquez.
That is the Defenders in the style of the Netflix Defenders. Yes.
You don't have to clarify that. That's what everybody thinks Defenders are but us.
We got some old school people in here. They know about Submariner. They know about Silver Surfer.
I'm just saying, Dave, it's going to be we're going to have to be explaining that these were not always the Defenders.
Right, sure.
So these are both original stories that sort of lead into the ongoing book. I like that Marvel does this.
Yeah.
Rather than reprint existing stuff, they create new stories that are shorter, that are just a teaser for upcoming books. I think Marvel makes a really good use of Free Comic Book Day.
Randy, I have an alternate notion on your Defenders thing. Okay. Is we confuse people to the extreme. They come in having watched the Netflix Defenders whenever that happens, and they're like, do you have any comics tied into this? And we give them something with Hulk, Submariner, and Doctor Strange, and we're like, this is definitely what you're going to need to read. You won't understand the TV show if you haven't read this.
Yeah. Boom, as always, has their all-ages sampler, which this year has Mouse Guard,
Cody
and the Creepies, and Brave Chef Brianna, which is one of my favorite new all-ages books. So all original stories, totally worth getting. Boom also is doing a Fresh Off the Boat book, written by Superman writer, or new Superman writer, Gene Luen Wang. And it's basically a goofy superhero book based on the ABC sitcom Fresh Off the Boat, which I know Nick is a fan of.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of it.
Valiant has a pretty good sampler. There's Exo Manowar, Secret Weapons, Bloodshot, sort of teasers for their universe. And all original stories, too. These are all little prologues. So,
nice.
Good sampler for their stuff.
Valiant has continued to kind of gain a hold in our store, and I think people should pick this one up and give them a shot.
Yep. And then we get into the reprints. There's plenty of those, but the ones I wanted to specifically mention, Riverdale number one, which is the Riverdale comic that we liked. It's not the whole thing. I think it's just the Archie and Veronica stories. But the Riverdale that we all talked about a few weeks back.
This is one that's kind of a prequel to the Riverdale show.
Prequel to the show, yeah. Yep. Wonder Woman number one, which is Rucka and Nicola Scott doing their Wonder Woman year one, basically, which the trade of that just came out this week. That's a good Wonder Woman sampler. DC Superhero Girls, which is a reprint of part of the graphic novel.
Hugely popular license right now.
And then,
as is this one.
Rick and Morty. Oni has a Rick and Morty reprint.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that will be our single most popular comic of the day.
Yep. And that's a few. That's by no means all, but that's right. Some of our favorites.
Yep, just a little sampler there.
But I would recommend everyone going to freecomicbookday.com and look at the entire list and sort of get your like mind in the right place.
Plot out your Christmas list.
Yeah, pretty much.
Of comics.
There will also be a couple things. We will have a limited number of the Iron Fist gold, white and gold pops. The Wonder Woman bombshells for sale.
Yep.
They have a couple of like, limited Free Comic Book Day things that are for sale. And I'm trying to think of anything else.
I feel like there was a HeroClix thing.
Oh, there is something HeroClix too, but I don't remember what it is.
I don't remember what it is, but I know that we do have it.
Yep. So yeah. Come on out on Saturday. It is the biggest day. Come out. Bring friends. Especially friends who don't read comics.
Yep.
Especially friends who have kids. But it's not just, this is an all ages event. So there's lots of good kids stuff, but there's also stuff that is very much aimed at adults. So this is the day to get all your friends and, you know what, your enemies into comics.
The store will be exploding with comic book energy.
Yes. It'll be Kirby Crackle on all the walls.
That's right.
All right. Other stuff going on with us this month. Nothing else in May, thankfully.
Okay.
We'll have a few weeks to relax for a little bit. Because our June is going to be kind of packed.
What about Free RPG Day?
That's in June.
Oh, okay. Thank God.
Basically, thank God. This weekend is the big event, and then we'll have 3 weeks in May. No big events for you guys, although there's a big event we'll be working toward. So June 3rd, Wonder Woman Day. That is Saturday, June 3rd. We will have Wonder Woman out from like noon to 3.
Yep.
You can take pictures with her, and there will be free Wonder Woman comics. First 100 people in the door will get the little cardboard wrist bracelets and tiaras. And we'll have a sale on Wonder Woman merchandise. Hoping that'll be a big day for everybody. That is the weekend of Wonder Woman's release.
Nice.
Hopefully it will be a day we all celebrate how good the movie was and not a, that was disappointing, but here's some cool Wonder Woman stuff anyway.
Yeah. Wish they'd sent us 1,000 of those Wonder Woman bracelets, though. Those
me
are
too.
I know that people are going to ask for them well beyond when we run out.
I wish we didn't have to pay for them. We would have gotten 1,000
of
them. But we're giving them out for free, just like we do with the comics, because we're good people.
That's right. We love you. We love comics. Love Wonder Woman.
Yep. And Free RPG Day will be 2 weeks after that, June 17th. And that will be our... we'll have all the Free RPG stuff. We're hoping to run some demos, maybe a D&D day with some D&D, maybe a Starfinder, possibly Star Trek. Try and run some stuff that day, so it'll be a good day to come out and play some RPGs, as well as getting some free RPGs.
For sure.
And then June 24th will be All Ages Awesomeness, which is the weekend after Free RPG Day.
Yep.
And so we'll have flyers for that at Free Comic Book Day, and we'll announce our lineup of all local artists this year, people from Dallas, Austin, Houston, and that should be a lot of fun, as it always is. People, you can come and get free sketches and...
Yep. It's always so cool to see what those people do. Yep. And like, I'm consistently excited throughout the day just watching seeing the drawings that they've done come by me.
Yep. And then the big announcement, which I alluded to a little bit last week, the store is expanding.
Yes.
So the week after All Ages event, and if you could see us, you'd see us all crying about how much work this is going to be.
Yep.
We're crying on the inside.
It's like that internet meme with the dude with the face that's like,
yeah.
You know the one I mean.
Yep.
I forget what it's called.
We are scooting from Suite 330. Where we are right now, to Suite 360, which is on the other side of CeCe's.
I think you reversed it.
We're in 360. We're moving to 330.
That's right.
Yeah. So we're just moving a few doors down, which is actually hopefully going to make it very convenient for y'all, as will our new size.
Yes, we'll be about half again as big.
That's right.
We will have a regular gaming area, which we've been asking for a long time.
Uh-huh.
We'll actually be able to run games and have open gaming. We're going to try and set up some schedule for that kind of thing. We'll have a lot more display space for comics and for games.
And hopefully just in general, like, kind of more elbow room for people as you're going. It's kind of a little compact in the store.
Yep. Although I'm sure we'll use all that up fairly quickly.
Instantly.
But yeah, we're very excited about this and also terrified because it's going to be a lot of moving, a lot of planning. So if you see me in the next couple of months and I look like I've torn all my hair out, it's because I'm bald. But also because I'm stressed out. But yes, so that's
if you had extra hair... It'd be gone.
Yes. So that's very exciting. But basically what's probably going to happen is we'll do All Ages Awesomeness. We'll close that Saturday. We'll be closed for 2 or possibly 3 days. And we'll open on Wednesday, June 28th in the new location.
Yep. And it's going to be cool as hell.
We have only one news item this week. And that news item is to mention that those of you who liked Logan, Logan Noir, the black and white version, is coming to the Alamo Drafthouse on May 16th.
The black and white version, is it going to contain any sort of director's cut type stuff, or is it purely the black and white aesthetic?
Purely black and white, as far as I know. Yep.
Which I guess they did with Mad Max Fury Road as well. Yep. Was it The Mist who got us all going on this way back in the day? Yeah. And come to think of it, since The Mist was directed by Frank Darabont, who would go on to do, direct the first episode of Walking Dead, did they not release some Walking Dead thing in black and white?
They did, like, the first season in black and white, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm gonna go and credit Frank Darabont with creating this movement for black and white movies.
So for you people who hate color in your TV,
yes,
in your movies, Logan Noir.
I don't think it's hating color anymore. No, that was the beautiful aesthetic of the original Bone. I don't think Jeff Smith was like, I hate color. If I can make this book popular enough, color will go away forever. Then he did a colorized version.
Yep.
And sold out his principles.
Yes. Anyway, this holds zero appeal to me, by the way. I'm not a black and white guy by nature.
Really?
But I get that some people are just like super excited.
So I think it makes sense. I really like black and white. But
why don't you just not have any color in your life then, Dave? Why don't you do that?
Sometimes I feel that way. it's my best Stephen Wright voice off the top of my head. I don't know, other than like sort of like independent movies I don't know if it fits Logan that well.
I think tonally it does.
I mean, you know, it's going to give it a kind of noirish look, I would imagine.
Yeah.
That's why I'm calling it Logan Noir.
Yeah.
Also because it's French for black and French.
Yeah. We'll see. Nick, are you going to go see it?
No.
Okay.
I mean, I'm sure it'll be released possibly with a Blu-ray or a subsequent Blu-ray release.
Will you watch it?
No, it'll be released with a Blu-ray. Black and white.
That's true.
It's actually being released with the black and white Mad Max Fury Road.
Okay, then I won't buy it because I don't like Mad Max. I don't like Mad Max, so.
You hate Mad Max as much as Frank Darabont hates color.
It's true.
But you only hate Mad Max because it's black and white.
No, I hate the color version of it, too. I do not discriminate.
Except against women, apparently.
Oh!
I didn't love it either. It was good.
I loved it.
It was good. Yeah, Randy.
All right. That's it for us on news this week. We'll be back in just a second to talk about comics for the week. We are talking comics the week of May 3rd, and I believe we all determined this is a pretty good week for comics.
Yep.
Yeah, it really is.
As seems to often be the case lately, I think because there's been so many, that we've had a lot of kind of large release weeks, I was nowhere near to getting done with my stack of stuff I wanted to read.
Yeah, I still have stuff I need to read, too.
And I found any number of good ones. There's, like, some good ones. There were some great ones.
Yep.
So I feel like it's got to be considered a pretty strong week overall.
This is actually a week in which I think I would pick any of the picks. The only one I would, might not is the one that I haven't read yet.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure one of my picks, too. So.
Yep. And there's, one of Nick's picks I know was, like, very considered for mine.
And none of mine.
Yeah.
Because you hate everything I like.
That's true. Yeah. Sorry, and it's just how it is.
I understand the dynamic we got. Nick, why don't you start us off?
All right, well, let's start with the big one for me. This is Secret Empire number one. I think I picked zero.
What? Controversy.
Yeah, well, yes, there is controversy that surrounds this series because, Cap is kind of a bad guy in some ways.
So what, you like Hitler now?
I guess in this connotation, yeah.
How many articles did we see that's like, Cap has always been a Nazi and all this
stuff? Way too many.
Oh, my God.
There were so many clickbaity articles.
It was
and
the
just
clickbaitiest superhero comic story of the year.
But I do think, I also like this book. I will preface it by saying that if you're put off by the idea of Cap being Hydra, you're going to hate this book. But you shouldn't, because it's really good.
See, I'm just approaching this from a story perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think
how we did with Superior Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Where we're like, Spider-Man lines. Becoming Doc Ock for a year or more or whatever it's going to be. That's terrible.
That sounds awful.
And then we started reading it, and we're like, this is pretty good. Like, it's actually really good sometimes.
And it sort of comes down to how it's written and the writing. And, I mean, the art is definitely something about that, too. And it's Steve McNiven here doing some pretty fine work for him. But it kind of comes down to Nick Spencer's story, and Nick Spencer's writing the hell out of this.
Well, I don't know about you, Nick. I mean, we'll talk about this later with The Handmaid's Tale, but I like a sort of bleak world where the Resistance is up against the wall. I like a story like that.
Like stories like that at times. I mean, Age of Apocalypse was that. Yeah. And if something along those lines always
every works. Single time the X-Men ever go to the future is...
Yeah, I mean, that's always bleak.
And that's what this is. Like Hydra has won. They've taken over. By the way, I do want to point out that the opening two pages is all about revealing the Cosmic Cube thing is Hydra BS propaganda and not the truth, just as I said it was in the previous issue.
You're not that reveal about Cap having, like, the you were always a Hydra member thing.
That's BS. It's Hydra BS. It is not the way the universe wants.
It was very clearly their sort of cult leader indoctrinating him in that one. Yep.
Nick, are you going to debate me on this? You still?
That's clearly
what they're saying.
I'm still not 100% sure that that is actually true.
You think that Marvel might settle on the notion that Cap has always been Hydra?
It's possible. No. Though I don't know.
I would think even if they are going to, they would have, because of the backlash, have come up with a radical, quick escape route to work into the book.
Do I think Steve will... I ultimately think that
of course
that's
he's going to redeem himself in some way.
In some way. But, I mean, can he redeem himself at this point?
I just think they open with this teacher telling all these kids...
About revisionist
history. About the revisionist history thing. That is as clear a symbol as I needed. That this is not the truth. He was not... Cap was not always Hydra. The Allies did not create the Cosmic Cube. That is the BS world that Zemo and them created with the Cube. That is where we're at.
If you believe it, Zemo didn't do it. Zemo and the... Red Skull had nothing to do with this.
I don't know who did it. Somebody did.
We will see, because I can see... I can play devil's advocate. I can see arguments for both. and I think that's where the controversy kind of, you know, is created with that, is because, you know, that is kind of a slap in the face of readers.
And I think that's foolish. It's unnecessary.
But I think that's also a good story.
What you liked about the story, Randy, was not that you were... Because you like this too, right?
Yes, I really.
And we'll get into a little more of the specifics in a minute, but there was nothing about the possibility of Cap having been this long-term legit agent for Hydra that the Allies only luckily undid or whatever.
No, this is
that wasn't what you appealed to. About
this is an alternate version of Cap, and that's why it always should be.
I mean, do I ultimately think this is going to be washed away by the Cosmic Cube? Probably. I think that's kind of an easy way out.
I don't think they'll go that route. I think if Cap needs the Cosmic Cube to rewrite his mind, then he's not Cap.
Right. And we don't know for sure. However, this first issue puts a lot of things on the table.
I have a quick question. Do you have to have read issue zero to do this? Like, should people for sure start with issue zero?
I would. I think there's a lot there.
I would too, but zero is basically the how did Hydra take over. This starts with where I think Secret Empire should have started. In the middle of... I'm a fan of starting stories as late as possible.
Yeah.
In media res.
And yes, and here's a world which Hydra has taken over and Cap is the head of Hydra.
Yep.
That's a more interesting... That's a better starting place to me.
Right.
So I like this brand and I like number zero by quite a bit.
But I still think there are interesting things in zero that
are going to want to get that
so
full.
So basically this
picture.
Opens up with kind of Hydra's in control and we get sort of a ground look at it through the
like
eyes
the world?
Of... Yeah.
Yeah.
And we get a ground look at it through the eyes of kids in school. And sort of, you know, we talked about the revisionist history.
That's intense.
But also sort of Hail Hydra is definitely in there. It's become sort of like the Pledge of Allegiance in some ways.
It's got a fair amount in common with the Amazon series, one based on Philip K. Dick's book, Man on the High Castle.
Oh, Man on the High Castle. There's
how quickly this all became normalized.
And sort of how people are, you know, told to report, you know, suspicious behavior.
Right.
People with powers, things like that.
Yep.
Definitely Inhumans are in the crosshairs, it seems.
By the way, I would rather that have been mutants, but whatever.
You know, I could see... Well, the mutants have their own thing. They've been sort of segregated themselves.
Yeah, they have their own, like, nation.
Which I thought was really interesting that Spencer's kind of doing across-the-board universe of everything.
So it is, you know, what we're seeing is an interesting alternate future kind of glimpse.
Yeah. And then going from there, seeing sort of Hydra, I say hit squads, but that's kind of right. They're, you know, kind of secret police. Then we get Carol Danvers, we get into her thing. And then, of course, there's the players of the story, which I always find interesting when they do this, mainly because they have it sectioned out in three different ways. They've got, or four, I guess, but Hydra Command, which are give you all the players of the Council. A new Avengers team, which is bizarre.
You know who's in that team, Nick?
I mean, Deadpool.
Yeah, you know why? He's a bad guy.
No, I think he... he blindly loves Steve Rogers. That's his one fault.
Hmm. Oh, or he's a Hydra sympathizer.
Back. What I'm more weirded out by the inclusion...
was always a Hydra sympathizer.
The people that I'm weirded out on there is Thor, or Odinson.
I actually can totally see that.
Scarlet Witch.
That's a little weird.
And Vision.
I can see Vision.
Unless Vision has been manipulated.
These are working for the bad guys, people?
Yeah, this is working for Steve.
He's Steve Rogers.
Vision can be reprogrammed. Thor is like the living symbol of Aryan power.
Well, and also, Thor's a guy who you can see, like, Captain America would tell him, like, look, we took over for the good of... And Thor's not a guy who gets into earthly politics.
Right, he might be like,
I guess.
The captain knows best, captain I shall do it.
I guess the one thing that Scarlet Witch is a little hard to swallow.
Oh, Scarlet Witch has been crazy in so many different ways.
Yeah, with especially on the team, including Taskmaster and Superior Octopus and Black Ant.
Yep.
Those are all kind of bizarre. And then there's Primary Targets, which are sort of the Resistance, who consist of, like, Black Widow and Hawkeye.
I'm super happy about making Hawkeye the head of Resistance.
Well, yeah, and it makes sense.
Yeah.
Nobody is more of a jerky rebel than him.
Yep.
That's a definite good call.
Yeah, they're definitely doing a little Han Solo-y thing with him. And him and Black Widow being sort of coupled up a little bit.
Yeah.
Running the Resistance with all these kids. There's a lot of meta stuff to be read into this, too, by the way. It's like, it's funny that all the younger characters that... younger, diverse characters that are sort of taking heat online, they are sort of the Resistance.
Yeah. Well, the champions are sort of the spearhead of the young Resistance mixed in with the old guard.
I don't want to say that Spencer might be filling his politics here. There might be a little Trump post-traumatic stress going on in his writing, but you don't have to look too hard for the symbolism in this.
No. but I think what is good is that it also reads as a pretty darn good comic, too.
Yeah.
And his inclusion of odd things in the Marvel Universe.
Other in it?
People do fight each other.
Yeah, there's some good action sequences.
And there's just some fun nods to old Marvel history. Like villains that they fight. The mechanical villains, I will say. I loved seeing them.
Yeah, that was cool. This reminds me of a lot of stuff that I liked about like Mark Waid's lesser-known book Empire that was about the actual day-to-day running of a Doctor Doom-esque... Like, this is they're not just... omnipresent bad guys. There's nuance and shade to how they interact and the choices that Cap has to make as a leader of a nation and not just the heavy Avengers.
Honestly, the boardroom meeting between Hydra High Council was weird and interesting, and Spencer gives a good representation of every player at that table.
And he's dealing with, you know, he's dealing with, like, Dr. Faustus being, you know, having his own agenda.
And
he's
also trying to undermine everything.
He's also trying to get Sharon Carter to come aboard, which reminded me of the Battlestar Galactica, where Starbuck was being sort of wooed by that Cylon that was trying to get her to get on board with the whole program.
Right, right.
There's also...
sort of how Hydra is influencing the entire world and sort of in these kind of proposed ideas of making it better.
Yeah.
Like, it's bizarre.
There's also a little bit of Firefly in here. The Resistance being sort of up against something much bigger than them.
Right.
And a sort of sense of, we've already lost.
Right.
Well, I mean, a lot of the hero's spirits...
Might have been the losing side. Not sure it was the wrong one.
Yeah, exactly.
Their spirits are broken in a lot of ways.
Basically, there's a lot... This reminds me of a lot of what I've liked in other pop culture, just filtered through the Marvel Universe. It's which is kind of what... It's what it does well. I mean, that's what Civil War did, that kind of thing. You want things that resonate with universal themes, and I think this does it really well.
Yeah. There's also some pretty dark moments.
Yep.
And one...
What are they?
Towards the end, I won't say, because I think...
Oh, I'll say it.
Don't read spoilers online for this. I mean, it's a good story. Give it a chance.
You're going to have more fun discovering them.
Yeah, I think so.
And also, the spoilers are going to come with people saying, oh, I can't believe they did this, because they're not looking at how it was done.
Right. I've actually seen, I mean, a lot of that. For sure, Superior Spider-Man is kind of the obvious thing. Where, like, if I had just read summaries of it, I would have been disgusted.
And
I'd be stupid for doing it.
I have to say that Nick Spencer's representation of Tony Stark, however, I'm still not 100% sure on exactly what this is.
Hologram, regular clone man.
But it is really interesting and perfect.
They make it much clearer here than it has been in the other thing we read.
Well, he does look like he's a glowing blue man.
Yeah. He's a hologram.
Yeah, but he's got, like, there's more to it than that, though.
Yeah, but it's clear that it's not Tony Stark. Like, was it number zero or whatever it was, where it was like, he was just in the armor, and I'm like, is Tony Stark still in there?
But it's almost like he can possess, like, this AI can possess things.
I don't know.
It's bizarre. And I mean, it looks crazy. The second issue, which I think hits later in May?
Probably in 2 weeks. I think they're doing the bi-weekly thing.
But it seems to focus on the heroes trapped in New York, which includes Doctor Strange and all the Defenders, essentially. I'm just really interested in all of this stuff.
I like this first issue quite a bit. I do think, I should say, people can legitimately hate this book and not be dumb. No, we're not saying that anybody who doesn't like this.
No. Right.
But I do think some of the backlash.
And I think we would agree that, like, or at least you and I, Randy, are like, do think it was a misstep to do the long-term Cap as Hydra thing. Yeah. Like, they might be getting a very interesting story out of it, and, like, Secret Empire sounds like it's worthy of people's time.
Yeah.
But, like, yeah, I can get people not liking that. That makes sense.
Yeah,
that's okay.
I totally get why people don't like it. What I think is that people should give it a fair shake.
Right. And like, maybe not lend too much credence to clickbait articles that are really there just to rile you up.
Yep. Dave, what's your pick?
My pick is a villain-based book, in a way, too, or anti-hero-based, from DC Comics called Bane Conquest. This is a 12-issue miniseries, I think, yeah, so it's a big old beast of a miniseries from Bane creator Chuck Dixon and Graham Nolan, who I think might have been the artistic creation.
Actually, or was it Warner Barretta, the creator?
I'm not sure. He definitely worked a lot with...
It might have been Nolan. I think Barretta it came in later. But Dave, was it actually an 8-issue miniseries and they pumped it full of Venom and it became 12 issues?
I like the idea.
I feel like it's represents...
It's 8 issues on steroids.
Yes.
A.k.a. 12 issues.
Yes.
Bane is a character that in the 90s that I was not so into. I kind of bypassed all of his stuff because I was kind of avoiding DC's big crossovers, and it all looked dopey to me.
You're like, who's this dumb wrestler guy who broke Batman?
That's exactly right.
Before you get into this, I do have a question for you.
Yeah.
How is continuity handled here? Is this Rebirth, or is this sort of set alone?
I actually don't know, but I get the feeling, to me it feels like it's probably... contemporary DC universe, but was probably written with Chuck Dixon kind of allowed to do his own thing.
Okay.
So I doubt it's taking into context
huge story recently in the Batman books.
He's being very protective of what he keeps calling his city, which I guess is Gotham. In a weird way.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
But anyway, yeah, so I was not originally a Bane fan. I kind of liked a little bit of what they did with him on Batman Animated Series, where they ran with the luchador kind of badass, but just for like an episode. Later on, I would go back and read the original Dixon story that was the launch story, and it was a really cool story.
Yep.
Bane as both this like super this powerhouse physical fighter and a mastermind, and I always had his kind of warrior's honor thing.
Yep.
I've liked a lot of stories with him since then, and this is kind of almost a return to form, and in some ways a 90s-ish story. But in a good way, and you know, think about, you know, Chuck Dixon on Nightwing and Robin and Batman and all that kind of world building he did, and the like kind of expert kind of espionage and superhero stories he did. What it begins with is there's a cargo ship like approaching. Let's see, I'm guessing. I don't know if they actually say for sure if it's Gotham, but they clearly are some kind of gangsters or mobsters or whatever, and Bane and his crew, he's got like two support guys who are like clearly a sort of a pilot driver guy and a tech guy who's like keeping drone watch over all of this for him, and he's like the one man commando mission ops team, and he boards this boat in the middle of the storm, kills the hell out of some people. he tears it up in there. And discovers that they were transporting, spent plutonium warheads. This is where it starts to feel like a Chuck Dixon book,
okay,
you know,
yeah.
That kind of slight kind of realism. There is, like, the guy on Bane's team kind of has a costume a little bit, looks sort of like a mercenary costume and stuff. And Bane has this kind of, like, how dare you enter my city with this?
Yeah.
But then they're like, okay, this was clearly not street gang level stuff. This is some kind of terror cell or something. And, okay, yeah, it's definitely Gotham. I can tell from what they just said here. And then they go on to, it's the rest of the issue is kind of him tracking down and his crew trying to figure out what was going on. Who was this meant for? What were they going to do with them? And there's some... just rock solid intrigue type storytelling.
Yeah.
There's some flashbacks to Bane's past that had one actually sort of disturbing possible addition to his backstory, which I don't know if it's quite what it looked like or not, but I I don't want to say what it was. It's interesting though. Bane delivers. I suppose I equate this with almost like the Darth Vader and Thanos book. Bane kicks some ass.
Yeah.
He definitely, this is no talky, mopey Bane or something like this. This is Bane at his Baniest.
Yeah.
Is he on Venom?
I don't think so, though. He does not get super jacked up at some point. He's just his natural super badass self. There are some brutal interrogations. This is a bit Bane as anti-hero, though, and not full-on villain.
Okay.
This is, you know,
he a lethal protector?
Code of Honor Bane, maybe a little bit. I have a feeling that if he ran into Batman, he would still beat the hell out of him.
Yeah.
But they're not afraid to put him in a bad spot, either. And I'm curious to see where they're going to go with some of what's happening in this. He's not... maybe unlike Thanos and Darth Vader, almost immediately he is in a kind of a difficult situation, or at least by the end of it he is, to the point where I'm like, in classic cliffhanger style, I'm like, man, I want to see how he gets out of this. This is a rough one. Anyway, these kind of guys are two old school pros who are doing what they do best and doing it really well. If you're a fan of Bane or any of those 90s, you know, era, like Chuck Dixon comics I mentioned, I'd recommend checking it out. Or just looking for some cool side bat books.
My comic is also a comic about a villain.
Yes.
Sort of. It is Predator Hunters. It's a new miniseries from Chris Warner, who wrote, I think, the early Predator books. He's also a guy who's high up at Dark Horse. And the artist by Francisco Ruiz Velasco, who I've always liked.
Oh, yeah.
Back in the day, he did that book we liked, Battle Gods, Warriors of the Chalk.
Yeah, man. I didn't know that dude was still alive.
Yep. So the art here is pretty spectacular. And it starts off, basically the first half of the book is some guys in a jungle being hunted by a predator. And it is scary as hell predator. And he seems to take out everybody but one guy. And then we jump to that guy working at like a mechanic shop. And he is the one survivor, and some people show up trying to recruit him for an anti-predator squad, and each one of them had a run-in with a predator, and they survived.
Okay.
And so basically you get the backstory of these
four. Any movie tie-ins? Any reference to Dutch or whoever?
Nope. Tie-ins to the comics, though.
Okay.
But there's four characters, all given pretty awesome backstories, and then they're going to go hunt predators. It's a great first issue.
That sounds super fun.
Yeah. I really liked it. I have not been following the Predator comics for a while. There's a reference here to something that appears in like Predator Omnibus Volume 4, and I'm like, I never read that story, but it gives the character a cool backstory.
Wow, that's some sort of a kind of deep cut, because those omnibuses are like the stuff from like, well, 90s and 2000s, like it means it wasn't something that just came out the other day.
Nope. Well, like I say, Warner's a guy who's been at Dark Horse for a long time.
That's cool. I appreciate that somebody's tapping the history a little bit in a good way.
But if you're someone who liked the Predator movies, but maybe has fallen off the comics a little bit, this is a good comic to jump in on. This was a really good one. My backup pick is, and this was tough to pick, by the way, because this is a big week. There's some number ones I would like to have mentioned, but I just love this book so much. And that is X-Men Gold number 3, which I've picked at least two of these issues.
Randy, if I'm not mistaken, some months ago, you declared that the X-Men would never be able to get to a place where you were interested in them again.
Shut up, Dave.
Just a thought, just mentioning, not unlike when you declared that no way that Marvel's Star Wars comics were going to be any good.
Look, you know what?
I want to give you room to make declarations for the future like these. So, anyway, I'm happy you're liking it.
Yes, no. yes, that's accurate, actually. I was very skeptical. I did not think that this was going to be an X-Men for me. I don't necessarily like the idea of Kitty being the grown-up leader of the X-Men on the faces of it. And yet, this issue ends the story arc, which I like a good short story arc, and while leaving room for more. It's the X-Men. They gather up a couple of their members. They go to take down the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. And there's a couple of reveals in there, which, if you're reading, the reveal's not like a bigger... Like, you're going to figure it out pretty quickly what was going on. But some good action. Kitty Pryde being a badass leader. Good moments for a lot of characters. And plenty of room for where it's going to go in the future. And this is... It reads like what I liked about the Claremont X-Men.
Well, what you're describing to me, and I haven't read it yet, there was a sense whenever I would get an old issue of X-Men back in the 80s, is that any almost any given issue was going to have a ton of interesting stuff in it. Like, it almost felt, you know, sometimes Claremont overwrote. But I felt like it wasn't until, like, the 90s that he really, really overwrote. And like, but I felt like I got a lot of bang for my buck. Good action, good character bits, lots of intrigue and meta plots building and you know, good, but also sometimes good standalone issues. Yep. Like, it delivered on a lot of fronts.
And, Guggenheim is definitely channeling Whedon a bit here. His quippy writing is pretty good. Quippy writing can be a problem. It's not always something I like, but I like what he's doing here. And he's got some good codes. You know, they've got the fastball special, all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
There's a good moment in here where there's like a kid who uses a code phrase. I like when the team does teamwork, when you see these people train together.
Yep.
So, yeah, it's kind of what I want X-Men to be, and no one's more surprised than me that that happened. but yeah, I'm super into X-Men Gold.
X-Men is evolving, Randy.
Into
us.
Dave, what's your backup pick?
My backup pick is one of those books that wasn't particularly on my radar this week, but ended up impressing me. From Oni Press, issue number one of The Damned. They should cross this over with The Goddamned, by the way. The Damned, which is a series that has been around before from Colin Bunn.
It was this pre-Sixth Gun book.
And Brian Hurt, for that matter, the artist.
Their pre-Sixth Gun book.
Yep. About sort of like 1930s era gangsters with demons and sort of mysticism mixed in.
Yeah, the demons are like the mob families in this 1930s. It's Chicago, isn't it?
Right.
I think it's Chicago.
I think so. And I wasn't sure, Randy, like, do people generally know about them? Like,
people in the crime world do, but most people don't.
Right. Like, most people, it's like regular gangster world.
Yep.
Behind the scenes, demons.
It's like Miller's Crossing.
Miller's Crossing was a heavy reference on them. Yeah.
Yeah. And I thought it was interesting that I was able to kind of jump into this without knowing too much about it. It's also, by the way, I just real quick, let me get out of here. It's just a buck, and I feel like this issue is, like, double-sized, so it's like, you get a shit ton of stuff with this one.
It's a good deal for a buck.
Our main guy is Eddie, who's, as a character I really like, he reminded me of an almost Constantine-esque guy, where he's... you know, maybe a little bit of a good guy, but he's running it like a mob run club, I think.
Yep.
And for one thing, it begins with him running through the crowd with his throat slit.
Yeah.
Well, which was an interesting start.
If you've read the previous Damned, then you know that he cannot die. Well, he sort of can, but there's an element. It's all explained in here.
Right. Yeah. I was very able to pick up on he has this interesting thing where he can potentially, like, on the cusp of death, absorb somebody else's sort of, like, soul and live on, but yet somebody has to sacrifice to him.
Yeah.
And, but then it kind of cuts to him, like, you know, it flashes back to kind of, how did we get to this slit throat version of him?
Yep.
And it's him running his club, talking, you know how, like, Constantine has this bravado? He's got kind of brass balls. Yep. He still gets in over his head sometimes. That's what Eddie in this reminded me of, that as he wheels and deals with, like, mobsters and demons. The dialogue was really cool. I really enjoyed seeing how he played them. The old mob talk is tons of fun.
Yeah.
It doesn't read just as pastiche, though. Like, I was worried it would just be kind of like, oh, just somebody playing it being writing gangster comics. But no, it's like this guy kind of knows, I feel like he knows the lingo of the era well and really lets the characters have some fun interacting with it.
Also, Hurt's art is great.
What have we been following him since? Queen and Country?
Yeah.
Yeah, like 15 years ago or something like that. There's some intrigue and bits of his past that come back. There's consistently interesting little bits of magic and how it works in here. It's, you know, it still has that sort of noirish tone. But like I said, it's kind of, for me, unexpectedly, a lot about the characters. I kind of really liked seeing all the characters interacting and vying for power in what I felt were, like, really smart ways. Like, you know, I'll keep coming back to the Constantine thing. I feel like he's a fascinating guy to watch wriggle out of problems, talk shit to people he shouldn't be talking to, sometimes take his licks as a result.
Yep.
It's just a lot of fun. Anyway, so, and it's a buck. So, like, I'm really strongly, strongly recommending people try it because I really feel you're not going to go wrong for a buck. It's a good book.
Nick, what is your secondary pick?
I'm going to talk about a video game tie-in.
A book
that probably stinks then. Every video game tie-in ever created stinks.
And I wasn't going to say that, but it's pretty
true. You know, actually, just real quick, before you get to this, there have been some decent ones. The Mass Effect comics are solid. not as... This is the only one that hits greatness, though.
Yeah, we all love this book, and we were all anticipating it because we liked the previous one, and Tom Taylor's back writing it.
What is the book?
This is Injustice 2, number one. Right. Which is a prequel to the upcoming video game release, and
a sequel to the last game.
And a sequel to the last game. Yeah. But
Bridging the gap.
It bridges the gap, yes. But from basically page one, this book had me. Just this opens the conversation between an incarcerated Superman and Batman, and Tom Taylor knows how to write a scene. Well, you know, writes it, like, insanely well.
Randy and I talked about this. Go ahead, Randy.
All the dialogue is good. Every
bit of dialogue.
Well, it gets to, though, what Dave and I were talking about is that with Captain America and Secret Empire, which I know Dave didn't get a chance to read yet, he still feels like Captain America. He's just sort of a darker Captain America.
Right, how he could have gone, another path he could have gone.
So this Superman feels like a Superman. He's you know, you kind of want Superman to be like Cap. You want to be the good guy, the mom, you know.
Yeah, like
mom
even like in an alternate universe, you kind of feel like he should be the guy who, no matter what, would never bend or break.
But you see this guy who was a little broken and just kind of got tired of people hurting themselves and decided that he was going to step in and fix all these tiny little things.
In its way, it fits with him. It's like, if you are sort of the most good-hearted, kind of honorable person in the world, and you see how screwed up the world can get, at a certain point, you're going to get tired of saying, oh, humanity just needs a little helping hand.
Yeah.
And you're going to think, well, maybe it needs a smacking hand.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and you're like, I know, I'm good. I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to just set them so that they can't abuse each other.
Well, and that's what I like about in this opening scene and about the general take that Taylor has is, he's not taking sides. There's definitely a part of this book that says, you know what, maybe Superman was right. Maybe Batman was wrong to oppose him.
Yeah. Right? Superman is like, it would be so easy and has been so easy in the past stories to do this kind of thing and make Superman the villain. And here, I mean, they make a point that he kind of gets some knocks in on Batman.
Clark, like, and a few giant.
Oh, man, there's something he says to it. I'm like, damn, that had to sting.
Yeah.
And Harley Quinn, who's there with Batman, says, that had to sting.
Yeah. By the way.
And Batman admits that he was right. And I was like, shit.
Taylor's Harley Quinn is the best Harley Quinn ever written. Perhaps even, and I'm going to say it, better than Dini's.
He has developed her into a character that, like, it's hard to argue against iconic stuff like Mad Love.
Sure.
But as far as a comic, the incarnation in like what I would call the normal sort of DC universe, even this alt universe, still DC-ish.
Yeah.
In some ways, more DC for me than regular DC. It's the best Harley I've ever seen.
Something that makes her own woman. In the cartoon, she was very much an adjunct to Joker. It was always about Joker.
But like her humor in this, although she feels like a sort of more mature version of the character, her humor is still Harley Quinn's. I still laugh at it. In fact, I laugh more than I do like in her solo books and stuff.
Yeah. No, it's fantastic. I love the way she writes a sort of semi-reformed Harley Quinn.
And Taylor's take on Green Arrow is probably one of my favorite takes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Right up there with sort
if
of
somehow, even though it would make no sense, there was a Green Arrow Harley book because they did have some great run-ins in this comic. I would, if it was written by him, I would read it.
I would too. Yeah,
but the scenes that, you know, with Oliver and
Dinah
and oddly Dr. Fate, it all sort of makes sense.
Right. I think one of the things he kind of got to do with this alt universe is put together groups of people you wouldn't normally expect to have a conversation with. There's in the very first Injustice, like maybe in the first few issues, there's a scene where Green Arrow's taken they've taken down Harley Quinn and they have her like held at his like Arrow Cave or whatever, and she ends up talking to Black Canary, and she's still distraught because Joker's dead, and she's she asks Canary, she's just kind of like feeling sorry for herself and crying, and she's like, did you ever feel what it's like to make all the wrong choices every time you pick a guy or something like that? And Canary kind of connects with her on that because when you're dating Green Arrow, who's kind of a giant a-hole half the time.
This is what makes Tom Taylor the best writer here, is that he gets little character bits like that.
Yeah.
Connections no one would ever make.
And kind of constantly, not just like every once in a while he does one of them.
No, and he does it.
It's every scene.
Yeah.
It does in the course of a pretty solid, interesting, like, the plot of this, and I don't know what's going on. I don't know what the alternate world stuff that's going on in it, and what exactly is going to lead to Superman and Batman being in conflict, because we know we're going to go that direction. Like,
probably.
I don't know where they're going, but the plot is interesting, too.
Yeah, and this book definitely has action as well, and you know, the inclusion of a few other hero or teams that we haven't seen before. And
right, there's one. There's specifically a team that I guess, are they going to be a part of Injustice 2, the video game?
Maybe, we don't know.
But it's cool to see it.
We know a few members are actually going to be playable characters. Okay. So, I did not read a lot of the Injustice comic beforehand, but I had no problem just jumping into this and sort of just being...
You're going to want to read the Injustice Year 1 and year try two, that out sure. in Year 2. Yeah. Those are at least the top ones, but as far as I can tell, it's continued to be good, so they've built a little mini-empire.
Also, Dave, you and I both on the Injustice comics, we weren't always 100% on the art.
Right.
Sometimes the costume design...
There were some very good artists and some pretty weak artists.
Bruce Redondo,
Bruno Redondo.
Bruno Redondo. Really good art.
He's very, very good.
Yeah, he reminds me of like one of those, it's not quite like Ivan Reis, but one of those really good realist type artists who can handle that and the superhero-y stuff really well.
Basically, I think they should give Tom Taylor the DC Universe and let him do whatever he wants with it.
I agree.
But no, because I still want him to write All-New Wolverine.
Sorry, he's got to stop it.
Nick, what else is on your stack?
Bullseye number 4, which is like the best portrait of Bullseye I've ever seen. It's fantastic. I cannot speak more highly. It is that good.
Try.
Nope, I will stop there. There's a new Tekken series. Yes, the Tekken video game, focusing on Jin Kazama and Nina Williams and all the people that you've played in the arcade and spent hundreds of dollars of coins.
Not me. I don't know who any of those people are.
You're missing
Tekken
out.
Tekken characters are fun. You know, I always... Does Tekken... Is it the same people who made Soul Calibur?
It is. There's, in fact, a couple crossovers.
Right. That's what I was thinking, is that there's a kind of a linked universe.
Yeah. I know Yoshimitsu
was... I know Soul Calibur, and there was never a Soul Calibur comic.
The soul still burns, Randy. There
was not. New series starting up, Black Bolt number 1. I am not familiar with this writer, but I know he's a novelist, Saladin Ahmed.
Yep.
This sort of is a very interesting book about sort of Black Bolt in a prison and him trying to escape. There is a cool backup sort of what is this comic about page.
I'm going to quick act out Black Bolt escaping from prison. Bye.
See, and there's the thing. The writer adds a lot of trappings that sort of makes sense.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't figure he would be just the power.
But that is definitely a question that's asked. Like, why can't he do that?
Does he make some toilet wine and run a cafe?
I'm sure... No, he does not do that. This does not have him running a space bar, a prison bar, anything of the like.
Okay.
New issue, 22nd issue of Superman, which continues the story arc. The all-new Guardians of the Galaxy number 1, like we mentioned in Free Comic Book Day. This is sort of them on an intergalactic heist.
Yeah, there's kind of a fun... I was reading the intro thing to Dave, and there's a little bit A-team-y. It's like you can go to them for help, and if they're not, they'll save the universe, or they might be running heists.
Yeah.
Okay. It's very much in line with where the Guardians, the movie, left off the Guardians. They're sort of a good, bad, a little bit of both.
Yep.
It's not what I'm used to from the Guardians, but I think it's a really good take on them.
And I love the artwork by Aaron Cooter.
Also, the thing they used to roll in a heist in this one is really funny.
Yes. Third issue of Iron Fist continues to be great. Jean Grey gets her new series with number 1 tomorrow, and has her fighting the Wrecking Crew of all people. And I just... Dennis Hopeless writes a good Jean Grey. I love the artwork by Victor Ibanez.
Yep. I've also come around to that costume.
Who is the little the Bamf that she's with? Is that literally from the Kitty's Fairy Tale verse?
No, that is actually from Jason Aaron's Wolverine and the X-Men. They had a bunch of those running around the...
Totally forgot about this.
And some of them latched onto Jean and a couple of other people, so...
But where do they come from?
They are, like... I forget exactly where... I don't think it was Kitty's Fairy Tale. It was something else.
So there's two different Bamf concepts?
Sure.
Okay. Anyway, I like the issue, too, though. It's a good issue.
And then the second issue, which I have not gotten a chance to read, of Ghostbusters 101, that sees sort of all the different versions of Ghostbusters collide into one comic. Which I thought the first one was great. I am looking forward to reading the second one.
Dave, what do you got?
Let's see. I wanted to mention new from Image Comics, Eternal Empire number 1. That's written by the folks that we really liked on Alex and Ada.
Yep.
Alex plus Ada. Sarah Vaughn and Jonathan Luna, formerly of the Luna Brothers, but striking out, if not on his own, with new partner Sarah Vaughn.
Presumably he's still a Luna Brother.
And I don't know. What if he killed the other? This is a fantasy series, and like a lot of, like, I suppose somewhat in common with the Luna Brothers stuff, that sort of has the first issue is kind of all about the getting a taste of it and the kind of the intrigue of this fantasy world where there's like an empress, I think, who's kind of clearly conquering and annexing and taking over places.
Yep.
While the slaves do all the kind of drudge work. And the story is about one of those slaves who manages to get away. But we know through kind of a framing device that there's also some sort of a bonding with a dragon going on. It was an intriguing first issue. I think it didn't grab me quite the way Alex and Ada did immediately.
Alex plus Ada.
I think they're kind of wanting to let this story a little bit more in the tradition of the Luna Brothers style kind of intrigue and draw you in. But I'm definitely interested to check out the second issue, and I figure anybody who liked the Luna Brothers stuff or Alex and Ada should check it out. I have to mention Sword Quest number 0, but Randy, did you read it? I didn't get around to it. So this is a super weird comic, but interesting. Oh, is it really only a quarter?
Yep.
From Dynamite Comics. If you lived in the early 80s or were a kid in the early 80s, you might remember a bizarre Atari 2600 game series called... it wasn't called Sword Quest, Randy. It was like Adventure... What was it?
I don't know. It's in here.
Oh, hell. Well, anyway, it was a series of linked games... Yeah. That were going, they were almost like, think a hyper primitive Legend of Zelda. They were kind of adventure games like that, but with a sort of an RPG-ish element, where if you played through all the games and learned these clues in them, you would be able to discover in the real world treasure. They had like this like gold treasure and chalices and stuff, and it was meant to be this big contest. And by the way, I think Randy, it was Sword Quest. I think there was Earth World, yep, Water World, Air right. World.
Yeah.
I was just misremembering it for a minute. And I think each one came with a comic that was drawn by like George Perez.
Yep.
So DC did a comic tie-in. So it was this kind of weird fantasy game series for Atari 2600. And it never finished. They put out one game and they never put out the other games. Nobody ever got like the treasure that you could get in real life.
That's actually apparently part of the story as I'm flipping through.
Right. And like it's like a meta, I believe. It somehow comments on it, but maybe has somebody traveling to that actual world. But yes, I see like somebody in it with a literal Atari holding that game.
Yep.
So it'll probably, even if you don't know this somewhat strange and convoluted backstory, I believe they're gonna tell you everything you need to know.
By the way, art and color are by Ghostwriter X. I don't know who that is, but Ghost Rider X looks a lot like Chris Samnee.
I would say Chris Samnee. Also, who is it? David Aja.
David Aja, yeah.
Reminded me of that. Some of the art from the Black Mask people.
Yep.
It's nice looking.
Yep.
But anyway, yes, a meta story about a strange Atari 2600 game.
Here's my question.
Yeah?
Dynamite's been doing a lot of stuff. They got the art of the Atari. They're doing Sword Quest. Are they going to be the ones to finally reprint the Atari Force comics?
Maybe. I can
see
that.
Somebody needs to put that in print, because I never got a chance to read it.
Here's a quick question. You know, old Atari 2600 games had almost no depth, per se, to them.
Right.
But would if you were going to take one of them and turn them into a comic, maybe just based on its cool box art or concept...
Yar's Revenge?
You ever play Star Raiders?
Yeah.
Where it had, like, a separate pad? It was, like, the complicated game of the
time.
Sure, I'm going to say Star Raiders. You know what? Maybe Pitfall.
Yeah, Pitfall would be a good one. Although it might just be like every other Tomb Raider and...
I think it needed to be kind of tongue-in-cheek and fun.
Yeah.
Remember there was a cartoon and he had like a cheetah or something on it?
Yeah.
Like
for real though, if there were Atari comics like based on these, they're going to get me. It's going to get me.
They need to, and they'd have to have you use like the same logo and font and stuff like that. All right, lastly I want to mention, just because I've generally been enjoying Champions number 8 is out. And that is it for me.
All right, well you guys covered most everything. But I want to mention... Noble number 1, which is the first part of the Catalyst Prime line that I mentioned earlier from Free Comic Book Day. This is there's sort of a military force hunting a guy who is presumed dead, who has pretty noble powers like telekinesis and flight and maybe some bulletproofness. And it's basically a sort of a black ops squad hunting this guy down and him taking them apart. There's a lot of sort of, hero on the run kind of stuff. So that's an interesting first issue.
Sounds cool.
Unstoppable Wasp number 5, which I've been really enjoying that book. And Extremity number 3, which is the crazy sci-fi with just stunning artwork by Daniel Warren Johnson and Mike Spicer. I also want to mention the first collection of Champions is out this week, collecting the first five issues of the book that we all really liked, and a second hardcover of Unbeatable Squirrel Girl, which is always really good. And if you don't know, she eats nuts and kicks butts.
If you don't know, now you know.
All right. We'll be back in just a second to talk about a couple of TV shows. Okay, we just wanted a real quick check-in on a couple of TV shows.
There are about 80 million TV shows coming up.
There are, and the strike was averted.
So, yeah.
So there will continue to be 80 million TV shows.
Yeah, no chance to catch up.
Just this week, Netflix will launch, like, seven that we don't know about.
The good thing is, I'm glad that it can... I would have loved to have a chance to catch up, but I would have been really sad to see some of my, like, Better Call Saul, or we're right now in, like, the golden age of shows, like... Better Call Saul, Leftovers, Fargo are all running. They're like my favorite shows. American Gods just started up, so we're going to talk about that. Handmaid's Tale just started up. It would have been sad to see them get cut short like a lot of things did the last time as a strike. So, also, a whole lot of people would have lost a whole lot of money.
Right.
Like a lot of writers would have been out of work and that would have sucked. So, I'm glad they were able to make a deal, and I'm glad that the writers were held firm and got some good things out of it.
Yeah, definitely.
WJ Unity and all that.
Pay those mofos.
Yeah. But anyway, let's talk about Handmaid's Tale, Dave. It was on Hulu.
Right. Kind of a silly, comedic, light, fluffy series.
Yeah, the handmaid is like wacky and she's always falling over things.
Yes. Each episode she tells a different crazy story of what the events were.
Yeah.
Okay, that's not what that happened.
No.
People kind of probably know this is a dystopian story that... even though I guess in interviews, for whatever reason, the cast was kind of shying away from saying like it's a feminist fable or whatever, it is. If for some reason you're scared of that word, it's clearly about women and sort of abuses heaped on them and the potential worst case. So sort of a worst case scenario for a future.
Yeah, this is based on a Margaret Atwood novel, which I thought I had read, but apparently I've never read.
I have not read it.
And it is. It's original to Hulu, but they released the first three episodes so far, and I think it's going to be week per week after that. I watched all three episodes. I don't know how much you watched.
Just the first.
So, it's interesting because they're doing some flashbacks to... The lead character is played by Elizabeth Moss. She is the handmaid.
Right. Which in this...
Elizabeth Moss from...
From Mad Men.
Mad Men and West Wing.
Okay.
So this... This is a kind of a somewhat near future, I guess I'd say.
Yeah,
in other words, visually it looks pretty close to now, but it has its own distinct style and oppressive feel to it.
Yeah.
But where
this sort of militaristic church organization has taken over,
right? And there has been a like some sort of a plague, or we don't know what. I doubt that it's probably ever important to know exactly how it came about.
Yeah.
But that caused sterility in it's like a high number, like 95% of women.
Yeah,
or
most
like
women
that.
Cannot give birth, and those that do, only one out of five pregnancies carry to term.
Right. And those, though, who are fertile are called handmaids, and they are essentially like almost like government property.
Yep.
That
they're sort of forced into surrogate for these sort of
become,
rich, barren women.
Yeah, to a sort of sexual slavery to produce children.
Yep.
They are... What is it that her friend tells her, describes her?
They're very much broodmares. I mean,
that's it. That's it.
But they're all the sort of hierarchy of the society seems to be they're all commanders, these male commanders. So it seems like there's a war going on against this resistance that we don't ever see.
Right. Feels a little 1984-ish in that, where in 1984 you often felt like that there were wars going on for sure, but that it also could be all manipulated and contrived to keep people in this perpetual state of fearfulness and aggression. Now, here there probably is, again, war, but there's for sure shades of 1984 in A Handmaid's Tale.
And this is very much the... it's a religious order. Like, it is a weird, corrupted religious order. So, like, this is not like a... HBOS, like, they're having orgies with these handmaids. Like,
so I'm gonna just real quick describe what happens when you do actually see a sex scene.
Yeah.
Which is to say, it's this extremely formal, sterile, horrific, the most unsexy sex scene of all time.
Everybody's fully clothed.
There's like, the guy, like, comes in, and he's wearing a suit.
Yep.
Like he's going out for an occasion. And he begins, like, he takes out, like, a little Bible and, like, begins quoting a verse that's the one that's about, you know, someone who was in, a woman who was infertile, and how she, in her greatness, asked her sister to stand in for her, to give a child to her husband or whatever. The handmaid just lies on the bed and sort of accepts her role with her head in the lap
of the wife.
Of the infertile wife.
The infertile wife who hates her.
Hates her.
Because she's having her sex with her husband. I mean, she doesn't like this any more than anybody else does.
Right. There is a kind of icy Cersei Lannister quality to her that's like, you know, you better watch out when you're around her. She's... And the handmaid feels like... Handmaids who are like seem like barely above, not slaves, but like house servants.
Yeah, more or less.
And like you feel like you cross this woman wrong, even though you are forced into this job, you could end up dead or something horrible could happen.
Well, it's clear that the last handmaid that she speaks ill of, that she said it was like training a dog, and they sent her off somewhere.
Yeah.
The woman, the wife, is played by Yvonne Strahovski, who's great here.
Yeah. She gets to kind of do some pretty serious work in this.
Then Elizabeth Moth's character, Offred, is her name. That's not what her name used to be, but she goes off to market with one of the other handmaids, who she doesn't trust, who she thinks is probably spying on her for the eyes.
Right. The eyes are kind of like the name for the internal security, I don't know what it'd be quite comparable. Police. It's the secret police. Yeah, exactly.
It's like, it's a very Nazi-esque thing. I mean, it's...
Yeah, you never know who might turn you in, and there's a sense that, you know, so you're careful around everybody, and although there is subversiveness, there is sort of resistance or at least hatred of what they're doing.
Yeah,
you can really only talk about it in whispers, and usually only with people that you know that like you grew up with before this kind of sterility plague and all that.
And even then, you can't be sure,
right?
Because one of the things I really liked about this is, in addition to showing this modern world and where she's at, they're flashing back sort of Lost style, where they show how this all came to be a little bit. So they show Elizabeth Moss as just a regular woman who had a husband and a kid and a friend, and they...
Right, you at least glimpse her, like, you glimpse her in college, sort of, where she's talking with her kind of party friend.
Yeah. It's more than that, because I've seen 3 episodes.
Right.
So they're definitely flashing back to how did it go from... Because you're watching this, and as I was watching it, I was definitely feeling like, I don't know that I really believe this could fully happen. Like, bleakest things can get, like... No one, the indoctrination, nobody resisting. Like it seems like someone will be standing up against this. It doesn't seem like, and then you see sort of.
I would think after the last election,
you would think I would learn, but there's a scene with a protest that turns violent in a very disturbing way. That was very chilling. That sort of showed how this could have gotten to this point.
Right.
And
what I was going to say about the flashbacks that I did see is that they also. I don't want to say they brought some levity, but they took you out of the extreme oppression, even though I know that probably some of them show some very dire things, taking you at least away to catch a breath away from this, like, horrific future is a sort of a tonal breather for the viewer.
Yeah. Well, and it's also, it's interesting to see that this is not like, this is not the Hunger Games. Where we're dropped into this world, and we don't see how it became this way.
Right. It's also not Hunger Games where you're like, I hope a savior rises up and just overthrows the whole system.
Yeah. No, but it feels like we're seeing how this is really close to the reality we were just in. Like,
yes.
Like this is a very, very believable way. And the only complaint I have is I still have a trouble believing in my heart. I'm like, I can't quite see it getting this bad. Without there being more organized resistance and, you know, terrorism or whatever else, it feels like everybody is very cowed, but they're showing us piece by piece how everyone became so cowed and how it became so terrifying that it's better to live in this than not to live.
Do you know, does anybody have any sense of, like, whether this was from the book or whether they're, like, expanding it a little for TV to kind of do more of that?
I don't know. My sense is that they're expanding it, but I don't really know.
That's interesting.
Yeah, there's a podcast that I listened to, The Secrets, Crimes, and Audio Tape, that did, like, a 6-part audio version of The Handmaid's Tale.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels very much in line with what you're talking about. Okay. So,
did they flashback and show?
I think, I believe they did.
That wasn't the part. That was the part I wasn't sure might have been added.
I think I was asking Tila about that, and she's read the book, and she said they did. But I do still get the feeling that they may have expanded upon the flashbacks. Sure.
Yeah. So I do have a question about Hulu. Has done some decent stuff. Would you say this is one of their best that they've produced?
Yeah, I probably would. I think I really like Casual. Which is their sort of serial comedy.
Because they do Casual, they do... What's their other big...
They did 11-22-63.
Right, and then there was one with the guy from Breaking Bad, right?
The Path, which I know our friend Les really likes. I have not quite gotten into.
but I wouldn't have say that their pedigree is necessarily amazing.
No, this is their big shot at prestige TV, and it feels pretty impressive.
It seemed like it's coming off for them. It's going well.
Well, that's good.
I did feel that at times it might have been a little on the nose.
Yeah,
like it reminded me a touch of how like Frank Darabont directs.
I can see that.
And I think I'm particularly thinking of the scene in the first episode where there's a guy, the scene with the execution of the rapist guy,
yeah,
Randy,
yeah,
which is a sort of a violent scene, and but it's kind of done in slow-mo and a little bit it felt a little manipulative.
Yeah.
I don't feel like it's the overall show has it's not like cheesy or anything like that. It just felt a little more, maybe a little on the nose, like I might want, oddly enough, a little bit more nuance,
sure,
to it.
Sure, into
that. But overall, I was pretty impressed. Knowing what you were saying about sort of their showcasing how it got to this, that actually sounds really interesting too.
Yeah.
I have a feeling I'll watch that and not be able to sleep
as I watched more and more. I liked it more and more. Now that I'm three episodes in,
I think the cast is all well chosen.
Yeah, this is very much verging on like I said, we're in my peak, my golden age of TV right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's like
yeah.
Fargo, Better Call Saul, and Leftovers are three of my favorite shows. I guess all to some extent a little bleak as well.
Yeah,
but this one ranks right up there with them, so I'm very happy to have it. The other show that just started, which is another big big launch, is Starz American Gods.
Yeah.
By Neil Gaiman and Brian Fuller.
Right. Gaiman is actually producing
this. He is producing and co-writing, I think.
Co-writing, I believe, yeah.
So, it's interesting. I'm a huge Brian Fuller fan. I'll watch anything he does. I loved Hannibal.
Right.
I love Pushing Daisies. I love basically everything he's done on TV. I have discovered in the past few years, gasp, choke, that I am not a huge Neil Gaiman fan.
Really?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people do, and he definitely has sort of a lot of people love him, too.
He's
so
very
it's kind of,
writerly. I always feel him inserting himself into things.
I can see that, yeah.
When we did, a few years back, Dave, we did a reread of Sandman, you, me, and our friend Jamie.
And then we all recognized how much of a stand-in Morpheus was for him.
Well, and sometimes, you know how we don't like to see the writer's hand as much as possible?
Right.
Like, his flowery narration and that kind of stuff is always very... this is a writer writing it.
Right.
Yeah.
In that, he reminds me of a writer like Ray Bradbury,
yeah,
who loved the poetry of language.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't necessarily think, it may not be for you, I don't think it's a strike against him, though. I think that's part of what people love about him.
But that is that's my complaint about the pilot, is that the thing about American Gods, the novel I didn't like, is that it takes a long time to get going, and you're like, what's going on? What's the story here?
Yeah.
And I feel like in TV, especially, the story here is there's a bunch of gods.
Yes.
But by the end of the first episode, you don't know who to root for, what's going on, what the story is, any of that stuff.
I think you have a person to root for.
You have Shadow.
Yeah. And he's definitely kind of the character. I mean, the viewer's character. I mean, you're seeing the world of the gods through his eyes.
But I feel like if you're not someone who's plugged into sort of mythology and all that kind of thing, the way that Gaiman and a lot of his fans are, this could be a little off-putting. That said, it's a really good first episode.
It is. It is violent as all get out.
Yes, although the CG blood is a little cheesy.
And I can roll with the cheesy. I think it works for the story being told. So
there were times in here I wanted to close my eyes and be in Westworld or Game of Thrones, which is a little better at this kind of thing. Starz does not have the budget that HBO has.
Well, and also Westworld, for all of it, I mean, it's kind of violence. The story it's telling is a little more serious in some ways.
I guess.
American Gods is kind of larger than life. And I mean, I know you're having AI uprising is not exactly, true to reality, but...
No, I get what you're saying. This is, like you say, Gaiman is a storyteller. He likes the larger-than-life aspects.
But it opens up... The scene, it opens up with a group of Vikings trying to get the attention of their god by beating the crap out of each other.
Yeah, yeah.
Was an interesting way to start.
Yeah.
But sort of from there, all the scenes were very interesting, and especially when you throw Ian McShane as Mr. Wednesday.
Ian McShane is what raised this from good pilot to amazing pilot for me.
Yeah.
Every second he's on... First of all, he reads the dialogue really well.
Yeah.
He has great swagger. He's loving this role. When they cast him, I knew that this was the guy, like, that's perfect casting, and it's perfect.
Well, he's the guy who I think has obviously been on the stage, like, doing plays and stuff, and that's what the way he reads it, and it just works so well.
They also, the other casting I really love that we've seen so far, because I know there's a lot of good casting here.
Yes.
Pablo Schreiber as, from The Wire, as Mad Sweeney the Leprechaun.
Oh my god, he was so amazing.
He's great. He's got that. He's fun, but he's also dark and dangerous.
Does he also have leprechaun swagger?
He has leprechaun swagger.
He does have a little leprechaun swagger, and pulls gold right out of the air.
Yeah, I liked that.
There's a sex scene that was Bill creepy Chris. As hell.
Yep.
My wife was like, "Oh my god, why am I watching this?" And I'm like,
"It's the commonality between that and Handmaid's Tale."
Yeah.
That was weird. But
was it supposed to evoke kind of the weirdness of mythology, like Zeus becomes a swan and goes around chasing every girl?
But it was sort of Bilquis, which is, I'm trying to remember, sort of the god. Who? She's the Bilquis. Hmm.
She's one of these love goddesses, basically.
Okay. Yeah, and sort of
she's getting her worship of her.
Was just done in such a way that is off-putting and creepy and probably exactly what you want from a god.
By the way, there's another Mad Men alum, the guy who is her prey, more or less, is from Mad Men. I think he's Freddy.
He's also been in a lot of other, a lot of stuff. But then there's the introduction of Shadow Moon, sort of getting out of prison early because his wife has been killed.
So Shadow Moon's a character first of all, that's a weird-ass name.
Yeah, but, and I'd forgotten that Gaiman, if he did it in the novel or not, they gave a reason for the name. He said his mom was a hippie.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, yes, the name is silly and kind of cheesy.
The reason for the name is that Neil Gaiman likes fancy names.
Well, sure. I assume that it's not just that he likes fancy names. I assume that this character has some role to play in a story about mythology.
Yeah.
So that it too. Would make sense for them to have.
Yeah, that too.
He wants this hardened ex-con to be named Shadow Moon, and I'm like, I don't know. Anyway, the guy playing him, I really like. I don't know who this guy is, but he's got some good presence. He's a good lead to go up against these sort of veteran actors like Ian McShane. He's got to hold his own with those guys, and
it's true. He does. And sort of just seeing him kind of deal with the loss of his wife, getting out of prison, and what that entails. And then adding this trappings of gods and then kind of screwing with his life in a lot of ways.
And then the final scene is very memorable. I don't know what happened. I assume it'll be revealed in the next episode.
But the villain who gets a hold of him, though, I don't know who that actor is.
I don't either, but he's really good.
He's really good and creepy as sort of a new god of sorts.
Yeah.
A god of technology.
This is all very well cast, very well written, of course, very well performed.
Beautifully shot.
My only gripe is the sort of CGI and a little bit of cheapness around the edges that feels very Stars. But
I feel it's like the top of Stars.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this is directed by David Slade, who also directed the first episode of Hannibal and set the tone. Like, the problem is I can't help but compare it. So I can't help but compare it to sort of HBO's best. I can't help but compare it to Hannibal, which was produced on NBC with a European cope and was spectacular.
I still don't know how they did that.
And this one... it does not quite have that professional sheen to it. It's a little bit cheaper, a little bit cartoony looking to me at points. But that is the only strike against it, because otherwise that was a really good pilot.
Yeah, I thought it was great.
All right, that about wraps it up for us this week. We'll be back next week with more, and until that time,
Yo Joe!
And that'll wrap it up for us this week. As always, you can drop us email with topic suggestions, things you want us to hear about, or just comments on the podcast at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at roguesgallery. Check us out on Facebook. Check out our website at www.roguesgallerytx.com. Check us out on Instagram at roguesgallerytx. And if you want to help us out, go over to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating and a little review. We'd very much appreciate it. And we will be back next week.